know, I guess it's been fairly long time. When was it you first got interested in the whole issue and the cause?
Well, it's been a long time. I started organizing about almost 20 years ago, and I got interested in community organization as a way of trying to solve farm workers' problems. So I was working in the farm, and there was a group in California called the Community Service Organization, which was beginning to organize Mexican-American people for effective political work, nonpartisan political work, voter registration, and getting people to vote, but we didn't care who they voted for as long as they exercised their right. And we did a lot of lobbying, trying to get some legislation passed. And took on a lot of the issues that the minority groups are confronted with and concerned with, like police brutality and the whole question of discrimination in jobs and in service establishments and so forth. And I got interested in the group through a priest that I knew, and then a few months after I joined the group, I was offered a job to become a full-time organizer. I didn't know anything about organizing and didn't know anything about meetings. I had never belonged to a group before. This is my first experience. And I was very frightened because I didn't know if I could do the job, but I was very interested at the same time. At that time, I was working in a farm near San Jose, California, and I was getting about, I think those days we were getting about 48 cents an hour. And so I came home, I told my wife that I had been approached, and they were going to give me $30 a week, which was about as much money as I got working in the farm, but it was much more exciting. So I began trying to organize then, and started from really from zero, from knowing anything about organizing, and paid very close attention to what the man that I was working with, how he did it, and didn't miss a chance, and worked as hard as he'd worked, and was with him constantly and observing, you know. And I became very engrossed in the whole question of organizing, and I've been at it since. I've learned quite a bit, but learned that there are no shortcuts and there are no miracles, and there's no magic in organizing. It's just a lot of patience and a lot of hard work, and you have to like people. You can't do it if you don't like people, because it becomes after a little while, it becomes very difficult if you don't like to work with people, because a lot of responsibility in organizing. As you go around preaching, telling people that things can be done, they begin to deposit their problems with you and expect you to do something for them. So you have to be, it calls on an awful lot of, you know, of your own determination to do things for them. And so I learned that organizing really basically means talking to people one at a time, and you can't organize by just talking to everybody. And then you don't organize through leaflets or through the radio. To have effective organizing, you have to just talk to one at a time, and that's the approach that I've used. And of course, everyone that I talk to, I try to turn into an organizer himself, you know, in other words, to the whole question of multiplying one's work. So the first thing I asked when I joined that group, I said, well, what is this group going to do for farm workers? And I was told, well, if this group ever gets, this is a community service organization, if it ever gets strong enough, it's going to help farm workers. So I stayed with them for about 12 years, and they weren't moving towards the farm worker that much. They were involved in many things in the fringes, but they weren't directly involved in organizing, I mean, unions. So about 6 years after I joined the group, I became the executive director of the whole organization, which was a national organization with chapters in the southwestern states. And I began to then make demands that we go into a full-scale organizing drive among farm workers. Finally, the group rejected the idea of organizing unions. So I left the group, and I was then in their main office in Los Angeles. And I went to, took my wife and my 8 kids and quit the job, and went to Delano, where my wife was born, and where I met her, and where we got married, and so forth. Returned back to Delano, and began to organize without any support from anyone. I would work a day or two in the fields, and then use the money for gas and for to buy materials, as well to buy mimeograph paper, which was, you know, that and gas was a real. And then my wife would work with me, and then later on I couldn't continue working because the pressure of organizing was too much, and I couldn't do both. So she stayed, remained working in the fields to support all of us, and I then began to organize full time. And that was a long time ago. So in the beginning we wouldn't accept help from anyone. There were groups who wanted to give us money or help, and said, no, we want to do it ourselves. We don't want anybody to tell us how to do it. We have certain ideas that we want to try. And if we get money from other groups, then we may not be able to. And the idea that we had was that with all the mistakes that I had seen committed in the other group where I originally started, I was trying to correct. One was that as the group became more, the CSO became better known and more influential, the leadership became more middle class, and the conventions were held for places where the poor people couldn't attend. And so effectively they couldn't be represented because they themselves couldn't participate, it was too expensive. And I set out to reverse that. And that's so much so that today, you know, in our conventions, in our meetings, we don't allow neckties. And we say, you don't have to dress, you know. You know, for this meeting, this is your meeting, this is your home. And the concern, you know, that, well, that we can't do that. For instance, they'd say, well, we can't organize union because it's a very controversial subject and we may be destroyed in the process. The group may be destroyed. And I used to argue that, well, that's what groups are made for. A group is organized to help people, and if it gets destroyed in the process, good and fine, you know, that's its purpose. How else can it succeed if it doesn't try? And so then the other thing was that we used to operate with mostly on, well, on money from people outside the community. And I set out to reverse that. So I wouldn't take money from anyone, but after about 8-9 months of organizing, we were able to set up our first foundation, our first meeting, our first convention, and the workers voted to set a monthly dues without any contracts or without any real union, but with a dream of organizing one, at $3.50 a month. And we went out and began to have membership and to, you know, assess them the $3.50 a month. The first convention, we had 200 people at the convention, and we signed up about 30 days after the convention. We had about 350 people signed up that were going to be members. 6 months later, we had 12 people paying dues. Yeah, it was it was very, very difficult. They were with us, and they liked, but they were very poor, and those $350 a month could very well be used for something else. And I was, it was, to me it was very difficult to insist on the dues, because I had been, well, working in the other organization where people didn't have to pay dues if they didn't want to. But I was determined that the workers themselves didn't pay for their organization, that they couldn't have one, that it just couldn't possibly work. So I remember in those first few years how difficult it was for me to carry out that order, you know, the collecting the dues. Sometimes I go to home, and like in the winter, and people were just extremely poor, you know. And I remember one evening I went to a place about, 6 miles south of Delano, another little town, and I went to this member's home. He was delinquent 2 months and hadn't paid, and I went, and I caught him as he was going out of the house, a little shack, and I talked to him about the dues and the responsibility and how important it was. He looked at me very dejected, and he said, "I have $5 with me." He said, "I was going to the store to get, to buy groceries." He said, "If you want to, I can give you $3.50 now, and instead of getting $5, I'll get, instead of buying $5 of groceries, I'll buy $1.50. And it was extremely difficult to stand rigid on the dues. And I hesitated, but I said, well, it has to be done, I guess. So I told him, you know, that that while, you know, this broke my heart to do it, that it had to be done, that I was convinced that if we didn't do that, you know, this and the dues, we would never have a union. And she said, okay. So he gave me the $3.50, and I gave him $1.50 back, and he went to the store to buy $1.50 worth of groceries. And I got home, I remember that it was in the evening, that evening, and I was feeling very, 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 well, I was very pained because of what I had done, and I was trying to justify it because in the hope, you know, that, well, if they pay dues, they'll have a union. And this was, about around 1963. That man consequently became one of the best members we had. And I don't know if that was a decision, but it, and in 1966, when we got our first contract, he was one of the first to benefit from the wages, about 100% increase in wages and benefits and everything.
Did you feel better?
Yeah, this is, so those were the early days when things were, you know, but even in the organizing in CSO, a lot of the work that I did was with the farm worker. I elected to organize in the rural areas and left the cities to some of the other organizers. When I became the director of the organization, I would work with the rural areas. And so I had, in those 12 years that I worked with CSO, I built an awful lot of friendship among workers up and down the valley. Plus, I knew a lot of them because of the days that I had worked with them in the fields. And so those were the, you know, the early beginnings. We didn't have, well, we didn't have hardly any, we didn't have any resources whatsoever. Every time we got a dollar, we had to decide whether we were going to buy gas or buy mimeograph paper with it.
Could I?
Yes, sure.
I mean, that's 20 years in all. It's a long time. I mean, if I to relate to you personally, I think of myself doing something like that, even though I may have come from, you know, I come from a lower middle class family, lots of different environmental things, but I mean, how do you stay with it? What keeps it going?
Well, one is, I can't really explain except that to me, there isn't anything that I'd like to do better than this. Secondly, I think that Well, I've always had hope that things could be, that social justice and could come and that people could be respected, you know, and their rights be given to them through organization. And I know how fully well how difficult it is, but also know that they organize, they can do something. But when I went through a through an experience in the early part of my organizing career, I had developed a, well, in those days I thought it was a very effective way of organizing. It was by developing very close personal relationships with the people I was organizing, and being of service to them at any time, day or night, any day of the week. And after about, well, from that time I was hired for $30, after about maybe 9 months of that kind of organizing, I was getting tired. And I was trying to get a day off to take my family to the park and to just, on a Sunday off, just get away from it. And I had been promising myself and promising my family and my wife that next Sunday we'll do it, next Sunday come, and my goodness, next one I'll do it. Finally, I said, this coming Sunday, I don't care what happens, we're going to go. The work was just, in those days, one organizer, we were very badly paid, and we had no help whatsoever. And I had a lot of help in the union now. In those days, I had nobody to do any work, so I had to do all of my correspondence and my stencils and the whole works, and do the service work and fight the fights for the individual members and so forth, and help them run the meetings and everything. So that Sunday came, and we got up very early and went to Mass, and we came back and to pick up the picnic basket. And as we're coming back, it was just getting off the car, there was a car full of people wanting to see me. They had personal problems. Somebody had been jailed in the family a night before and been beaten by the cops, and they were very upset, a young man. And so I stayed there, you know, looking at the people wanting help, you know, and my own personal recreation. And my wife and my kids in the car, you know, waiting. So I decided against going on the picnic and went to help this family. So it took me almost all day and part of the night. I didn't get home until about 9 o'clock that evening, and told my wife that I wasn't happy. I said, I'm not happy because I'm torn between wanting some time for myself, and at the same time I want to give people a lot of time, and it doesn't work. I have to make a decision. So she's been very great about this. She's been very understanding. One of the reasons I've been able to do all these things is because she'll, you know, support me. So I told her I was going to work another from 4 to 6 months, and I was going to have to make a decision. That if I decided I was going to stay, this meant then that I was going to literally just give up my own personal life in that time was concerned, and I was going to devote every minute that I had to the cause. And if I couldn't do that, then I was going to quit and do something else. So I continued working and thinking very seriously and very hard about what, you know, but the decision had to be made, and I was trying to make a commitment, a total commitment. So at the end of the 6 month period, I talked to her and I told her that I thought that I couldn't spend my life doing anything more worthwhile than working with poor people, and that even if I went elsewhere to do something else, that even if I had time, I wouldn't be happy, and that I thought that the best thing for me to do was to continue doing this, but also to tell her that if I continue organizing, I would have to then change from being of service to literally being a servant to people, just working. And she agreed. I find a little time for my family, you know, but it's become it's part of my work. They're included in what I do. And so that was a long time ago, but 18 years ago, so. And once I made the decision, I didn't have any more problem, because I wasn't torn between, and I think it was a good decision. If I had to make it, I'd make it all over again. But I set my mind at ease, and I made the decision that the people would come first, and that I would work, that there wouldn't be any days off, unless, well, there was nothing to do. And even today, you know, when I have much, much more help, I can delegate a lot more work and responsibilities to other people. But even today, if I'm at home and someone comes with a problem, I don't care if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, Sunday or a holiday, I'll get up and do the work. But but this time I do it gladly because I've already crossed that problem, and it's much easier. Many organizers have never made that resolution, and so they find themselves trying to organize and yet eating themselves out because they can't have their time for them. You know, they can't have it both ways, they can't. And, so.
Well, you know, it's one thing to make a decision, but how do you stick with it? I mean, you have, but that's not an easy thing to do.
Well, I really don't think about it, you know. I've been too busy. My life for the last 20 years has been like one long day, you know. It's just everything putting together. It doesn't stop, it's just... they've been happy days, happy years, all in all, you know. Well, you know, organizing is a lot of disappointments. But they're short-lived and they're just minor things. But on the overall, I'm very happy that it's turned out this way. And much more so because I've been able to be a part of it.
Do you drive? This is a way, is a very trite question, but I'm not sure how to put it. I don't mean it in a trite way. But you derive some support, not only from your wife, but from a belief in a kind of God.
That's the foundation. Because you see, you can't very well place all of your hopes in economics. You can't really place all your hopes in other things. And I think that fundamentally, there's got to be some belief somewhere. And so, well, in our own faith, we've been taught, you know, from childhood, some of the things we're doing are the things that we expected to do anyway. And I think that belief is the fountain, you know, it's the source of strength. But it's not, how should I put it? It's not a passive belief, you know. It's not a belief, is the word contemplated being a good word? No, it's more than that. It's, you know, here are the people and here's the suffering. And we're literally commanded to do something about it, you know, and let's do whatever we can. And this is kind of, so it works out, you know, it does. And even when things don't turn out, the way you want them to turn out, there's always, and even in the face of the biggest disappointment, there's always that faith that tomorrow is going to be different. And sure enough, tomorrow is always different. However difficult the problem may be, however difficult a decision has to be made, and the next day, things are a little better, always.
Right.
Yeah. Because see, by the same token too, the same belief makes decision making in one area very difficult. And that's, for instance, political decisions can be made, you know, and technical and decisions involving strategy can be made. But when it comes to moral decisions, then they're hard. Because most moral decisions means that you have to stand up against your friends in many cases. And those are difficult to make. One always knows the answer, but one is not always willing to offend people, you know, or at least, you know, have people who are close to you be offended because of the decision. And I've always said that moral decisions are the most difficult to make. You know what the answer is instinctively. Everyone does, I suppose. But making the decision to affect other people's lives, you know, that critically is difficult. But they have to be made, and they're made. And usually they're not understood by the affected party. In 99% of the cases, they're not understood, and in 100% of the cases, they're never accepted. Within time, things change, but immediately, no. Then, also, on the whole question of organizing and, you know, demanding that people strive for excellence and strive for success in organizing, which is the basis. Once the decision is made, the moral decision to be nonviolent, when that's made, then what I call hard-nosed organizing is the essence, you know, of keeping the nonviolent alive, of preventing people from going to pieces because they get discouraged and frustrated and so forth. Not because they're nonviolent, but because they're sloppy organizers. And so we work very hard at that.
Could you talk a little more about that?
Well, I look at organizing as something that is not really that vague, but something that's very concrete, and that of all the experiences that I've had, and the places where I failed to organize have been only because I was not willing to give the time necessary to do the job that had to be done. But in those cases where I've been willing to give all the time necessary and the work to do, it's been successful. And so we say that organizing, and more applies much more so in a struggle of our sort, the sort of struggle we're in, that organizing can be accomplished, and organizing is something that can come about, and that many times people who are organizing will find excuses for their failures. And the biggest scapegoat a lot of times is nonviolence. Nonviolence is the first thing of all the things that can be checked off. Nonviolence is the first one that's checked off. Instinctively, people say, nonviolence doesn't work, we tried it. Well, nonviolence really means action. Because if I were to be nonviolent and lock myself up in my closet and then tell people, just be patient, nonviolence, things are going to change. They'll never change, and people will become impatient. But if I say nonviolence is the way to go, and be patient, but work very hard and be accomplished organizers, then things will change, and surely they will change. And if we stay, see, in every contest, whether it be even in contests where it's a, even in sports, in any contest, in order to win, you have to be in the defensive, rather on the offensive. If you're in the defensive, then of course you're going to lose. And this is nonviolence then in struggles like ours gives us unlimited, unrestricted opportunity to be on the offensive constantly. And we don't have to then be confronted with what so many organizers go through, that they are detracted from their course. For instance, people who are people who are concerned, who are organizing and leading movements, who are concerned for human beings, basically are nonviolent. And if they choose violence, they choose violence only because they feel that violence is the shortcut, or that the only alternative left to them. So I contend that anyone who is willing to sacrifice himself and his family and all of his things that he has for other people, by nature is nonviolent, but uses violence only when he gets cornered and feels that he's trapped and there's no other alternative. So our job then is to prevent ourselves from being trapped and finding that we have no alternative and being cornered and being disillusioned and frustrated and then going the violent way.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means then, it means that we have to be very, very, we have to be very truthful with ourselves. If we are not succeeding in organizing, we have to admit it. Because generally people say, well, the people don't want it, or the people won't respond, or the people don't care. And those aren't excuses. To me, they're not valid. People have problems. If we show them the way, they'll do it. I may not be able to show them the way, and people won't respond, but they want organization, because anyone knows instinctively that that's how you get in the head. So if we can then prepare organizers that they'll be successful, then the chances of being cornered and frustrated are much less, and the chances of violence then therefore less.
I just wanted to... I used to be a law student, and you obviously must have a certain attitude towards the law, which hasn't always been in your favor. You know, what's your general attitude towards the law?
Well, see, the law is the laws that applies to those who have the power. The law, when it comes to those who have the power, is very difficult to apply. And the law, as it applies to those, or as it concerns those who do not have the power, it can very easily be extended to cover any and all things that they do. It's,
Oh, there's only two cars? What happened to the other car?
Well, it's built in such a way that only the rich can have proper justice. The poor can't have justice under the system.
What is it that said that the law says that both the poor and the rich have equal rights to sleep under the bridges of Paris, but only the poor really need to sleep there?
Yeah.
Or rather that neither can sleep under the bridges, but only it only applies.
Only the poor have need to leave. Yeah.
How many days did you fast?
The last fast, the long fast, was 25 days. Well, it was quite an experience. It would take a long time to tell, you know, all of the experiences, but some of the, you know, more some perhaps of the most important ones, I would say, were the whole question of food, you know, becomes irrelevant after, in that fast, which was my best fast, because I fasted before. After about the third day, I didn't have any craving for food or any whatsoever, any pains or any hunger pains or anything. And after about the seventh day, I didn't have any pains whatsoever. You know, usually muscular pains that come with it. And by about the 10th day, I was, I had entered into, I can describe it, but it was a, a state of complete calm began to discover, you know, that I didn't eat but more than 2.5 to 3 hours of sleep every 24 hours to get along. But that it's almost impossible to get excited or to get or to feel any anger towards anyone or anything. That things that minor things that eat away at us normally, you know, tend not to be that bothersome. Important, yes, but not that bothersome. And a real clearing of the mind, really sharpness, able to retain sometimes conversations verbatim, and able to recollect extremely well one of the things that I did in the moments when I had a little time was to sort of just try to recollect all of my life as far as I could remember and try to reconstruct it and see what had happened and how it happened and what had affected what and thing, and those things that I was proud of and those things that I had done that I was ashamed of. And quite an experience. It seems that it's in, that the mind has a capacity for storing, you know, events and memories. It's an endless. And then the senses become very sharp too, especially hearing. I was able to hear very well, and much more than people around me. And
the habit may be too strong now. I may not be able to break the habit of grabbing it, but I'll try.
I think that then.